All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Tunes Mate, episode number 80. I'm Mark.
And I'm Ray.
And Ray, interesting, had an opportunity to sit down with Bill Toms. You may remember Bill was on the podcast a few years ago. Once again, we have a second round on the podcast, and he has a new single, and he's working on a new album. And this is the same thing we've been talking about. There's a lot of artists that are just releasing a single with building up an album at some point, and that seems to be the new trend, even though you said this is going back to the 1950s. And we also got onto a discussion, or we also had a discussion around the power of a set list, and it was something that we had talked about on another episode. But he did confirm, he's like, yeah, you want to come out strong, and it's like a roller coaster. You know, you're trying to get people up on their feet and just trying to keep them engaged, which if you've ever been to a concert, that's exactly what the artists are trying to do.
No, that's exactly, as you said, the plan of a concert. You want the right order of things so that you, as you said, you start off strong, you get people going, and then you have your kind of slower moments in the middle to kind of, you know, give people a chance to rest or to chill out for a little bit and chill with the music. And then usually kind of want to end off with a bang, right? So yeah, there's a whole like art to building a set list.
Yeah, and we also got into a conversation about, I asked him, I said, well, if you were giving advice to someone that's becoming an artist or trying to become an artist, he said, it's just, you have to understand the music business side, that you have to build an audience, and it's going to take a lot of work to do that. And you look back at many bands starting in clubs and working and going, and I think we talked about this too, that really nowadays the only way really to survive is to tour, because there's just so much music out there. But that was another interesting point, that you have to understand that music business side to survive.
Yeah, no, it's that, you know, refrain that you hear in lots of things where, you know, just being an artist is, I mean, you have to have skill or talent or ability of some sort to do it, but then you have to have a sense of the business that you're in and how that works, and you have to be able to work that and have that kind of skill as well. And I mean, that's a crucial part, and you see a lot of the successful folks are people who either learned how to do that themselves or worked with people who could do that for them, right? And then, so if I can't do it, I've got somebody I can trust who can do that for me. And of course, you know, we go back to the history of pop music where, you know, lots of artists have been taken advantage of because they don't know that part. And they, you know, they sign bad contracts, they get into situations that they really can't handle, or they don't have the skills to work through. So yeah, you know, and so touring's a big part of that. You know, you got to get your music out. We've got the most fragmented pop music market that we've ever seen. And I mean, it, you know, before the development of the big studios and stuff, it was fragmented in the way that it was regional, but there wasn't the volume that there is now. And so you got to get your music out there. And that means whether that's, you've got formats like YouTube, et cetera, and you're doing it online, or you're out there getting the music out to people where they can see you, they can hear you. I mean, and you think about it, right? How many times have you gone somewhere and you saw a band, or maybe you went to see one band? I remember when I went to see Hey Marseille for the first time, and they were actually one of four groups that were playing. There was a local group that was first, and there was another guy, I think, I might be getting his name wrong, Nathan Richardson, I think. He was from Toledo. And then Hey Marseille played, and then Seawolf played after Hey Marseille, and I had never really listened to Seawolf. And I mean, as I told him, the leader of Seawolf, afterwards, I was like, I came to see Hey Marseille, and I ended up buying all of your CDs too. You know, you go out and you see this stuff, and you get exposed to this stuff. Or like the Ohio Weather Band, they came and played on my campus, and I went and bought like all their work. You know, you see that, you see folks play, and that's really important exposure, where people hear your music, they get exposed to it, and they go and they buy your stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you go with one purpose and you come back with another one, and it's reflective of that love of music and the just discovery. And that goes back to the purpose of Tunes Mate. We always talk about this, but that's why we're constantly giving you exposure to other songs, other artists, and it's why we're here. So that's really reflective of the music that's out there. Well, at this point, let's take a listen to the interview. When we come back, we'll wrap up the episode. And I have the honor of being joined by Bill Toms. Bill, how are you?
Good, Mark. How are you?
Pretty good. It's been a while. It's been a couple years.
It has been. You know, it's nice to get back, and we're not under the umbrella of COVID too much, but, you know, so.
Yeah, it is a different world.
Last time I talked to you, we were kind of like locked in.
I know. It's so amazing where we've come, and I know that's impacted performances and creating music, and I did come across a new song called I Fulfilled My Dream. Was that something that was created just recently, or was that something that was brewing around for a while? What's the origin of the new song?
Well, no, it's fairly new. I wrote it probably about a year ago. And I think that what it is that as you get older, and I'm 63 now, and when you're young, you know, you have these dreams, you have the ambition to do a lot of things. And, you know, as you go on the journey, you're wondering whether you're fulfilling anything. And then when you get to a certain age, I know for me, it was like you look back and you can actually see it clearer. And I remember when I was very, very young, I was like 21. My father died when he was 22, when I was 22. But my wife and I started dating. And at that time, all I wanted to do was play music. That's all I wanted to do. And I met my wife. She had a child. She had a two-year-old. And I said to my father, I says, man, I don't know. I don't know if I want to get, you know, caught up in all this. You know, I want to be a musician. But, you know, I love the fact of having a family. And my father says, well, if you want something, you work at it. You work very, very hard at it. And if you want two things, you just work double hard. And I kind of took that with me, you know. And so, you know, as hard as it is, I was able to sustain a music career, have a family. Now I have three daughters. I've got a fourth grandchild on the way this summer.
Congrats.
Traveled all around the world because of music. And so, yeah, I look back and I says, yeah, I did. I might not be a millionaire. I don't have a big house. I don't have, you know, fancy cars or anything like that. But I have, you know, even though the burdens are heavy, you know, for everybody, no matter who you are. And success and a lot of money or a lot of material things doesn't fix any of that. And so I looked back and I thought, well, you know, I did fulfill this dream in my own way. So, yeah, that's where that came from.
It was interesting because I listened to it a couple times, trying to understand. There's a lot of different layers in the song. And when I first heard it, I was kind of tapping my foot along to it. And then I started listening to the words and then I started kind of grasping some of the concepts you're just talking about. And then you've got the guitar solo and then you move into this, it's kind of like a chant. And I'm just wondering where the kind of the pace of it came from. Did it start out that way? Was it the song itself, the melody and everything? How did that come to you? Was it something that just popped into your head and then you just wrote it from there?
Yeah, well, it was just one of those things. I think I started with just, the guitar rhythm to it and the chord changes and sort of the melody came right after that. And then when the words and everything else just kind of flowed organically, even the chanting at the end was just one of those things where I was sitting in the studio with my producer, Rick Wachowski, and I just started, like, chanting at the end of that song. I just started chanting. He says, go throw that on. You know, he threw up a mic and says, put that on there. So that's what we did. It wasn't something that was planned. It was just spontaneous.
Yeah. I know comparisons are always hard, and a lot of musicians do that. But when I started hearing that chant, I started thinking about so many other songs that right around the end where you start getting that chant. And then I started envisioning how the crowd would react to it. And I know that was one of the things that we talked about last time is when you're touring and you're out there, that connection to the crowd. Have you thought about how the crowd's going to interact with this? Have you had an opportunity to play it live?
We played it one time and it went well. It went very well. I'm looking forward to honing this song, you know, live. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where it might be something that the crowd joins in on. We may, you know, I may have to, you know, stop the band and let the crowd play sing, you know, through it. But I don't know. I'm going to let it go on its own and see what happens with it.
That's something that my colleague and I that run the podcast, Ray, we were talking about in our last episodes about the challenge of a set list. You know, you're out there, you know, the chemistry of it, you know, do you start off with something that is right out of the gate, going to get everybody's attention? Do you save your biggest song to the end? And now you have another song to put into the mix of things. I'm curious about that. What is your philosophy when it comes to your set list? Do you have, is there something that you think about? Is it more about the audience, or do you have something that you generally use?
Yeah, well, I think it's how I feel or how the band works. You know, I like a set list that is, that moves, you know, it touches all emotions. You're going to come out, with something that is going to capture somebody's attention, something dramatic, you know, and then, you know, you rock and roll a little bit, you know, your soul music, and then, you know, then you're going to bring it down a little bit, you know, so it's sort of like this roller coaster of emotion, but you always want to get them, you always want to have them on their feet at some point in the evening. Once you get them on their feet, you know, then you have their attention. That's how I work it. And there's certain songs that, you know, as you go, you know, certain songs work early, certain songs work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Towards the ends, you know, there's certain songs that you say, well, that's my second song. and no matter where you put it, it always seems to work best as the second song. So.
That is, yeah, and that just comes over time. You talked about the song and how you've learned that over time you've fulfilled your dream, as you said, and you start understanding also what works in a set list. And what's interesting is I was looking through your website and it talked about some of your favorite albums. You know, Tom Petty was mentioned, you know, Dan the Torpedoes, Springsteen's, you know, Darkness on the Edge of Town, and then The Clash with London Calling. And I started thinking, you put all those together, does that equal Bill Toms? Is that all the influences there? But it's interesting though, if I think about, you know, some of your music and chemistry, I could see how all these artists have definitely impacted your sound.
Sure. I mean, that in those three albums are probably the albums when I first started playing music, you know, when I first in the late 70s, you know, mid to late 70s, when I started playing guitar and started playing music. Those three albums were brand new, you know, they hit me the hardest, and mostly because of the guitar work, because of the songwriting, you know, the passion of the music. But, you know, if I go back even further, when I was a kid in the 60s, you know, I had older sisters who would listen to soul music, and soul music was all, you know, the Stax records, you know, Atlantic Records put out all the, you know, the Aretha Franklin stuff and Motown. That's what my sisters would listen to, you know, and they would go to dances in Pittsburgh, and they had, you know, the music had its own sound here in Pittsburgh, you know, garage rock or whatever. But soul music always was sort of my first love, you know, everything from Otis Redding to Sam and Dave to, you know, Wilson Pickett. So that, I think that, you know, has influenced my presentation, whereas the other songs influenced my songwriting, my playing guitar, you know.
And yeah, I've listened to your last album, and I've definitely seen a lot of clips. I haven't had the opportunity to see you play live. but I do understand that you have a very, I would say, fulfilled band, to stay on the fulfilled theme. And I know you've got a pretty strong horn section there. That's got to dip right into that soul.
Yeah, definitely. And I always wanted, you know, I always wrote like that. I always wrote more on a soulful path, even when I was with the House Rockers, you know, when I would co-write with Joe, you know, we wrote Soul Survivor together. And a lot of these songs that were, you know, they're based around, the music was based around soul riffs and soul chord patterns. So, and also the melodies. As I started doing my own thing a lot more, I realized that, you know, I could sing some of that stuff. And we had a drummer that, Bernie Herr, who started, was playing drums with us, who was a great, he's a great soul drummer. So I was able to just kind of like dig into that and write a lot of those songs. And I knew just naturally he was going to play them, you know, the way they're supposed to be played.
Yeah, it's amazing. And talking about playing, you, with your last song, you talked about you were in the studio and with your producer and you said, hey, you know, throw that chant in there. Was there anything different around recording this process this round as opposed to the last time we connected with your last album?
Not a whole lot, other than we might have used another different studio for some stuff. But for the most part, you know, I really enjoy this way of recording. Most of the time I start a track or start a song at home. I go into the studio with Rick Wachowski, who is a fantastic musician himself, as well as, you know, a producer. And we just start putting things together. And then the guys in the band will, you know, they have their studios at their houses, you know, and they have their own, you know, recording devices or whatever. And they'll send in parts, and then we'll get together sometimes in the studio. I usually do most of my vocals will be at the studio, not in my house. But so, yeah, I mean, I just enjoy it because it's, you know, I can walk down the steps to my studio in my house and I can throw ideas down. So it's a lot easier. It's a lot less, you know, trying to gather up, you know, it's like herding cats trying to get the band together. so yeah, it's less, hectic and less, not so much stress that you have to get this done, you know, in 4 days. So, yeah.
Yeah. I've heard that many musicians have said, yeah, I'm going to do as much as I can before I get into the studio. And then even thus far, build your own. I've seen many musicians do that. I mean, there's that famous story of, you know, Eddie Van Halen that said, oh, I'm going to build a racquetball court. And then he built the 5150 studio. Yeah. So it's there's some flexibility and control there that you
have. Yeah, exactly. You have the control, you know. And, you know, so many times in the past years, you know, we've just been under the gun, you know, and it's just not a, it's not my favorite way to work, you know, where you're watching the clock tick and the money is pouring out and, you know, you feel like you have to get this done right. And maybe there's some compromise that you didn't want to compromise. And so I like it better this way.
And see, once again, there's that experience. You've been able to see it many different ways and it helps.
It does. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you realize that, you know, I don't have to stress myself, to do this. I have other means to do it. And, you know, we have the technology. And I always, you know, as I got older, and I think it was from the last record, Keep Moving On, when we had COVID and we couldn't get into a studio together, I realized that, you know, the recording process should be looked totally different than a live performance. I know that's sacrilegious to a lot of people, but I started to enjoy the fact that I'm making a recording. I'm not performing a concert. And it's for me. And if I'm getting off, if it's moving me in some form, moving some emotion, then chances are it's going to do the same for the audience, or at least a lot of the audience.
That's a great attitude. I mean, if it's affecting you, you then know you will impact the audience. And I guess what's interesting is you talked about the experience that you've had and that helps. What if someone is trying to break in now as a musician? Would you have any advice to them? Is there a hard part of the music business that you would tell them they should think about as they kind of embark on this journey?
Well, again, I think that what my advice would be to anybody that's trying to do this is to realize that it is a business. And, you know, that once you see it as a business, now you can, the music part of it is easy. You know, that's, you're doing that out of the, you know, the passion of with this, what's within your soul. But the business part of it is the hard part, because people that are trying to make money don't really care how much passion you have for your last single. You know, they care about how many people are sitting in the seats, or, you know, how many, streams are being downloaded or whatever, streamed. So yeah, it's you know, you have to realize that. You know, I have to laugh a lot of times. I see people say they'll get online and talk about how these, well, the clubs don't do nothing. You know, they expect you to bring a crowd, and you know how, you know, well, I mean, it's a business. You know, people don't make any money if there's nobody in the seats. And so it's a lot of work. You have to work to, and the hardest part is the connecting with an audience, but there's a lot of work involved with that. And I would, another thing that I would tell upcoming musicians is, you know, work very, very hard to connect with your audience. That's the biggest thing. It makes all those other things, the business part of it, a little easier if you're connecting with an audience.
Yeah, so it's the passion, sure, but connecting with the audience, and you talked about earlier how with your set list, that's something that you're doing. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I've been to my share of concerts in my lifetime, and I've definitely seen how some artists have a way of interacting with the audience more so than others. Right. And I really think, as you said earlier, there is something to the work and the preparation. And I know you've got a really extravagant band that you've put together, and all those things matter. And I think, Bill, just listening to your album and listening to some of your concert footage, it sounds as though you're planning for another 2024 of doing a similar thing out there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and what I realized too is that nothing lasts forever. You know, I mean, so I'm really, really enjoying what I do right now, and I'm not taking it for granted. I'm, you know, kind of like holding on to it, you know, and appreciating what I have right now. Because, yeah, there's a lot of mouths to feed. You know, you can't just take a 9-piece band on the road and make a whole lot of money anymore. So, you know, I understand what the limitations are, but I love it. There's a part of me that just, you know, when that train starts rolling, I mean, I can't believe it. You know, I can't believe I'm on it, you know? And so I would imagine that the audience is feeling the same thing. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, it sounds like you've got this new single out. Mm-hmm. Is there plans for more singles? How are you approaching this? Are you going to do a full album, or are you going to just create single by single and release them?
I think what we're going to do is, you know, this is our second single that we released in the past year. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to finish up a bunch of these songs that I have and release a full length. I'm hoping for, you know, around the end of the year to have a full length, you know. But again, I'm not under the gun. I'm not rushing anything. Just taking our time and, you know, enjoying what we're doing right now. It's a weird world when it comes to releasing records, you know. I mean, it's I just remember we were talking the other day to somebody. I says, when I was young, when I was a teenager, the thought of making a record was, you know, daunting. I mean, the only way you would be able to make a record was if you had a record company, you know. But now it's just a whole different ball game, you know. I mean, you can record your record on a MacBook, you know. And young people are doing that, and they record it in the morning, release a song in the afternoon, and off you go. You know, you got your gig that night. it's just totally different than when we started out playing. Good or bad, it's just what it is. So, you know, I'm just gonna ride, and if we have to release singles, that's what we'll do. I mean. But I know a lot of our audience still likes to hold a record or hold a CD in their hand. So we'll continue that for a little while as well.
Yeah, and there has been a resurgence I saw out there in vinyl, and I even saw cassette tapes, and I'm like, okay.
Next thing you know, it'll be 8-tracks. You're probably exactly. Too young for 8-tracks, right?
I still have an 8-track. I do remember 8-tracks. I actually do have an 8-track player, but it's definitely, I don't have too many, but it was really, I thought it was odd that in the middle of a song, it could just flip to the other side.
Take a click.
Wait a minute. I was just enjoying that. What happened?
Yeah, right.
It isn't.
But then whenever you heard that song again, if it was on a radio or something, you think, well, where's that click at? You know, you'd be waiting for the click.
Exactly. It preconditioned you. Well, Bill, it's been great catching up with you, and I really enjoy the new single that you have out there. And are you planning on going out, and you've got some more gigs coming up around the corner?
Yeah, we'll be in, we're going to do a Pittsburgh show here on April 6th to kind of release everything. And that'll be at the City Winery in Pittsburgh. And then we go out to the Philadelphia area the following week. And then we go play Columbus, Ohio the week after that. So yeah, you know, and some summer festival things.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, before we close, any funny stories from the road there, Bill, that you can? Ernie, do you have any pranksters in your band?
You have another 2 hours.
Let's do part three.
Stories out the wazoo. Off the top of my head, you know, one of the funny things is when we would travel over to Europe, and the one time I was with Phil Braunz, our sax player. We were just doing like a duo or a trio traveling through Italy. And we were staying at a friend's house, his apartment. And there was a little washer machine in the bathroom because of these apartments are kind of small. And my bedroom was just right around the corner from the bathroom. And I was taking a nap in the afternoon. We had a gig that evening. And I was lying in bed. And the next thing I know, Phil is in my room standing over me with a mop and a squeegee, you know, and I'm trying to figure out what the hell, what are you doing, man? Well, here he tried to wash his clothes, forgot to put the little hose in the tub where it's supposed to drain the washing machine, and it just was pouring out. I mean, the water was just, it was like a half inch on the floor. And he's got this little mop that he found, and he's trying to mop it up. He says, I don't know what happened. And so it was a funny scene. You had to see it with me sitting there looking at him, and he's got his pant legs up to his knees, you know, and coming into my room and mopping the floor like Carol Burnett, you know. you know, that's just one of the things, you know, that.
Yeah, you can't make that stuff up.
You know, washing your clothes in the bathtub, you know, and because the washer machine wasn't working or something like that, or it was just a lot of crazy things.
It's all the stories that nobody knows while you're performing on stage, how you got there, all the crazy things.
Right, because you're playing, what are you playing, 2 hours or something? Yeah. And the, you know, you got 22 hours left in the day.
Exactly.
All kind of stuff happens.
A lot of mayhem. So. Best of luck to you out there, Bill. And everyone, take a listen to the new singles that you're releasing, and there's an opportunity for some new music in the future. Always great to catch up with you, Bill. And how do people catch up and find out more information about Bill Toms?
Sure. BillToms.com is the best way, I think.
Easy enough.
You know, yeah. We're on all the, you know, the digital platforms. So,
well, check it out, Bill. Once again, it was great to catch up with you here, and look forward to you again. This is your second time now on the podcast. So
yeah, I'm a regular.
You're going to have to come back again.
I'm a regular.
That's right.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill.
Bye-bye.
All right, Ray. Well, that was interesting. He has his own recording studio. I think many artists do write their music. And he worked out a lot of it before he went in to the actual studio to record it. And started talking about, well, Eddie Van Halen back in the 80s built that 5150 studio. And that revolutionized the way he recorded music because there wasn't as much pressure, can write music. And I think that has plus and minuses. I think you've got you may not want to record today, so it may take you longer to create music. And at the same point, you have that ability to record whenever you want. And I think that's changed a lot of the way the music is being released.
Yeah, it lends itself to folks capturing music. I mean, how many times do you write something and you lose it by the time you get to, you know, a chance to record? I mean, how many, you hear all the stories of people with the tape recorder by the side of their bed or something like that, you know, where they, I gotta record it. And so now having something right there at home, you can go right in, you can at least lay down a basic track or something to, you know, to have it. Or if you want to work on refining something, again, you don't have to be in the studio. You can be in there working from home. As you said, you know, it's the give and take, the yin and yang of working from home, right? That, you know, then at the same time, you kind of maybe feel like you're always busy and you're always working. But it allows you to feed that creativity, allows you to create more. And it may lead right into, hey, I got this thing and I'm not going to wait for an album to release this. I'm going to put it out there now because I've got it now. And, or I'm going to release, you know, my official studio stuff, but then we're going to do this side stuff that we put out there that's like, you know, home recordings or impromptu concerts or other stuff. You can do that right there at home. And so it's lending itself to all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, and it's definitely showing the tremendous release of new music that's out there. And we've been seeing that. But a lot of it now comes down to how you're also using social media. And there's been so many songs that are released to TikTok, for example, then all of a sudden become mainstream. So I think it's also that balance of how you're using social media that at least I've seen some stars start really getting out there and getting more exposure.
Yeah, and that's exactly it, that with the advent of social media, that also impacts the music creation and production and distribution industry and or process, right? And so you can, and again, when you've got your home studio or you've got your, you know, some kind of means at home to record this, it makes it that much easier to throw it out on TikTok or X or whatever, you know, wherever you do it.
Yeah. And they asked, you reminded me of something. One, I remember MySpace. That's where everybody's put all their music. But it is interesting thinking about that idea of becoming an artist. And I do remember there was a Smithsonian interview with Eddie Van Halen a few years back, and somebody raised their hand and said, well, would you advise people today? And he basically said the same thing. He's like, you have to get out there, work hard with your band, create music, create a brand for yourself. Not a lot has changed other than the industry. It's about getting out there. And he said, look, he's like, we came out with hard rock music in the middle of disco and we made it. So, you know, there's always going to be some uphill battle. And I think artists today have the same challenge. Sure, there's there's volume and everything else, but I love when you compare it back to the 50s, how there's a lot of similar patterns. It's just new territory.
Yeah, that's it's both like the 50s and different from the 50s at the same time. It is that, you know, you just release stuff and you didn't wait for albums and you put out singles. And, you know, we've talked about that over and over again. But then the degree to which you have to have things like technical proficiency, or you have to have the distribution means at your disposal. You know, there's elements, the media that you use to get it out there. You know, there's a lot of differences from the 1950s at the same time. And so it really is kind of about navigating all of that stuff. And a lot of times it's a crapshoot, right? It's, you know, back to that thing from Eddie Van Halen, you can try something and, you know, maybe the type of music or the genre you're working in isn't the most popular at that time, and you still do your thing. And maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. And we've seen, you know, numerous artists who either they continue doing their thing until it hits, or they never hit, or they change and they, you know, they completely adapt themselves. I mean, you think of that same time period, right? The Bee Gees completely reinvented themselves into disco and then became, you know, one of the biggest act on earth in the late 1970s. And so it's really about navigating that, and how do you want to navigate that, and what do you want, and what don't you want out of your career and your music?
Yeah, it's a great example with the Bee Gees, because they even came back later with One. That was the 80s. And then they later even had some hits in the 90s. They kind of morphed into more of like an adult contemporary artist. Hope you continue to follow our blog and subscribe to our podcast. And we're excited. We have some other interviews around the way. There's so much music that we're bringing you. We hope that you continue to give us your feedback about it and follow.
Yeah, no, we're going to keep putting it out there. You know, Daily 80s Flashback, Classic Artists, all those, you know, time period type stuff that we're looking back 25 years, 50 years, 5 years, and keep putting it out there.
Yeah, it's definitely been fun. Always find something new every time I tune in. I had no idea that, I think it was Johnny Gill had some song called Half Crazy.
Yeah, back when he was a teenager in the mid 80s. That's, you know, he was still, I think, still even working with New Edition at that time. And before, you know, we know him from like around 1990 with Rub You the Right Way and My, 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 and, you know, his kind of solo hits then. But yeah, he was actually doing it back then, back with us. Wasn't he with Stacey Ladislaw? They were trying to, you know, push these young teenage African-American artists in the mid 1980s. And there was getting a little bit of crossover, but doing really well over on the, with the time called the Black Singles Chart.
I mean, it was a piano ballad. Yeah. I was not expecting that. And everything about it was very dramatic.
Yep.
So I was expecting this, like you said, that very R&B danceable style. And I was like, okay, I never heard this before. So there's always something to add to your playlist and explore. And that's what we're doing here. So we hope you follow our blog and subscribe to our podcast. And once again, I'm Mark.
And I'm Ray.
And we will see you next time.